Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, director of the UCSF Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education, about industry support of research, Tales of Deception. He has done some important work nationally with multiple industries, tobacco, the sugar industry, discovering real tales of deception. I'm looking forward to hearing it and talking with him.
Yeah, me too, Christy. You know, we've had to deal with tobacco industry in North Carolina for decades. We know the difficult it is to take on an industry and telling the truth about the health consequences of these products. And so we're looking forward to having this conversation with him. But first, we got some interesting research that matters about weight loss and teen smoking. And this is really interesting research, Christy, because we've known for a long time that most people who quit smoking, on average, will gain about 2 pounds. That also means people lose weight, people gain more weight, but there is a little bit of associated weight gain for people who quit smoking. And I guess the converse question is, are there some people, and particularly teens, that are smoking as a way of trying to lose weight?
Yes, this was research done by Cornell University, and they looked at data from the Health Behavior in School-Age Children Survey that was done from 2001 to 2005, and it was done for over 10,500 U.S. school children who were 11, 13, or 15 years old. They reported their heights and weights, and they answered questions about their perception of their body and also about different risky behaviors like smoking cigarettes.
And basically, in this research published in the journal Health Economics, where these teens were reporting their weight and the perceptions of their weight, and basically finding out that a lot of these teens who were overweight were using smoking as a way of trying to lose weight. And the concern is that this might be a technique that's used to market products to overweight teens. And some encouragement that this connection between weight loss and smoking needs to be severed. I think what we really need to do is to focus on weight loss on those who are overweight, focus on smoking cessation among those who smoke.
And try to prevent children
both
from starting for the wrong reasons, right?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting research. More to come.
Okay, let's talk about the dreaded colonoscopy drink. So for you listeners out there who've ever had your colonoscopy or have ever had a friend or a parent or anyone who's had to have their colonoscopy, you hear people complain about the yucky, icky drink that you have to drink that makes you go to the bathroom to clear out your colon so they actually can see what they're looking for.
Been there, done that.
Not pleasant.
Yeah, Christy.
Not that bad.
I'm not quite sure you're at that age yet.
Yeah,
Christy.
Well, I'm not going to divulge too much information on the air.
Yeah, you're probably
like
32,
yes,
so, you know. I will say that it's not the worst part about a colonoscopy. The worst part of a colonoscopy is the colonoscopy. But a lot of people are given sedation. But that whole preparation is not pleasant, and the whole drinking of a drink that doesn't taste very good, it's kind of too sweet, isn't great either. So the question is, could they devise something that makes that experience much better? And it sounds like they probably have.
Well, and the truth is, up to 40% of all colon cancers could be prevented if people did their regular colonoscopy screening. So getting your colonoscopy is really important, because if you catch something early, they can remove it and actually prevent it from becoming cancer or catch those cancers early. But if people won't drink the drink, and I got to tell you, Adam, I heard so much more about how bad it was, and I had to drink it myself, and I didn't think it was that bad. But for a lot of people, it's a major barrier. If we could reduce that barrier, we could save lives.
Yeah, and this was research that was done at Dartmouth, and they found a company called Culinary Concepts, and this company is producing bowel-clearing food bars and drinks. It sounds like
exactly
what it is, but they would taste like fruit smoothies and chocolate, lemon cooler, coconut, white chocolate, strawberry banana, vanilla shake, and, oh my goodness gracious, mixed berry and orange. This sounds kind of interesting.
Well, and of the people in the phase two trial of this, the top three most effective bars, they had the bowel cleansing that was rated as excellent or good by the people looking to see that it actually did clear their colon. Patients reported that they were more satisfied. So perhaps it's reducing a barrier.
And they're going to start into some tests to see if this also may well be a treatment for folks with constipation. Next, doctors really order too much imaging, too many MRIs and CAT scans for people with low back disease. I think that's undeniable. What do you think, Christy?
I completely agree. And we know from the Choosing Wisely campaign, which was published in 2012, it recommends very clearly against imaging scans for low back pain unless there are specific red flags that would indicate something more serious going on. Usually, x-rays, MRIs, CT scans don't find things that actually change the outcome or change even the advice or recommendations to patients, and yet we do them often. Patients want them and feel like they're getting more information, but it doesn't change what we do. So there are risks and costs and radiation and other things associated with some of these tests, which require us to be more thoughtful about ordering it.
In this particular research, almost 600 physicians, nurse practitioners, and physicians assistants from the Veterans Administration got a questionnaire and then a hypothetical scenario in which a 45-year-old woman with low back pain requested a CAT scan or an MRI. And only 3% thought that this patient would benefit from having it. And 3/4 thought that they would worry that a scan would lead to more unnecessary tests. But a large number of these physicians said they probably would order it because the patient was requesting it. And this really raises some concerns for exactly the reasons you say, Christy, and also increasingly a lot of the cost for these tests that are getting passed on to our patients. If they have a good health insurance, they may be denied. And if they don't have great health insurance, they're going to have to pay for it. I think this is a real problem, and probably there are going to be stronger controls placed upon these things that hopefully most times will benefit patients.
Well, I think the doctors were concerned about having enough time to explain the risks and benefits. It's complicated to explain and sometimes are rushed for time, and so they perceive that the patient wanted it. When a lot of times, I think we'll discover that when patients understand the risks and benefits, they may not want to bear that cost. When you're really talking about the cost and what it would benefit them, many people would not want to pay thousands of dollars for a test that doesn't have use.
Not me. Speaking of rush for time, I think if I were out there drinking and I needed to find out my alcohol level, and I had a tattoo on my arm that gave me within 8 minutes my alcohol level, that's better than getting a blood test that takes me 2 or 3 hours, but I'm not sure it answers all the questions here. What's this next research?
This is a collaboration done by some nano engineers and electrical and computing engineers at University of California, San Diego. They looked at implanting these tissue chips that resemble a temporary tattoo, but it really is a biosensor patch that is able to detect how much alcohol is in your blood and then send a signal over to your cell phone.
You know, this is like a space age technology, and it probably does work. I'm not sure it's ready for prime time. We have a day and age in which the decision to get behind a wheel could be made within a minute, and it takes 8 minutes here, and I think it's an interesting technology, but I think we've got some existing things that prevent people from getting behind wheels and driving. That's what we need.
Well, we're talking about 88,000 people in the United States who die from alcohol-related causes. So this is a step in the right direction. Needs more study, needs more evaluation, sure. But we need to have better preventive measures and techniques to prevent people behind the wheel.
Do you get to pick your tattoo?
I guess so. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah. I might have a fun one, maybe of a flower.
All right. Well, you and your flower cannot get in the car. Okay. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and director of the UCSF Center for Tobacco Control, Research, and Education, about tales of deception, industry support of research. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research.
To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor at the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine and director of the UCSF Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education, about industry support of research, tales of deception.
Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Glantz.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, we've known each other for a long time, and I must say you are one of my heroes for your work taking on industry. But tell us, how did you get started in research? And I doubt that you one day woke up and said, I'm going to take on the most powerful industries in the world.
Well, my original research work, both as a graduate student and a postdoc, and then as when I joined the faculty here at the University of California, San Francisco, was on the mechanical determinants of cardiovascular function and what determined how the left ventricle and the heart, the big pumping chamber in the heart, filled and emptied, and how the different chambers of the heart were connected to each other and how that affected their performance. And I got into the tobacco issue back in 1978 when we had an initiative campaign here to have no smoking sections. That wasn't smoke-free. It was just to put the smokers on one side of the room and the non-smokers on the other. And it just seemed like a good idea to me. I had a little asthma, probably because my parents smoked. And I went down to volunteer, and I've kind of been there ever since. And one of the things I learned in dealing with the tobacco issue is that you're up against a very determined, rich, powerful, and ethical opponent. And over the years, I decided that I should be studying the tobacco industry as a disease vector.
I know this is all very common information for you and for me and for Adam, but help our listeners have a picture of the kind of deception that you uncovered related to tobacco research and the tobacco industry's influence.
The earlier work we did was a lot of detective sleuthing and kind of reverse engineering the statements that tobacco companies were made in political discourse. But in 1994, a box of internal industry documents landed in my office, which had communications between their senior lawyers, managers, public relations people, and scientists that really let you get inside the industry and just see very frank discussions at the highest levels. And, you know, for example, while the tobacco companies are still in many places in the world contesting whether nicotine is addictive or not, in 1963, the top lawyer at Brown & Williamson Tobacco wrote a memo saying, we're in the business of selling nicotine, an addictive drug. And one of the things you can see when you get into the documents is how the industry views scientific research and manipulates scientific research. And they have really two completely different research enterprises underway. One is their internal research, which they use for product development and marketing. And that work is of quite high quality, often 20 or 30 years ahead of what the mainstream scientific community understands. For example, the tobacco companies had figured out by the 60s that nicotine was an addictive drug, and they had a pretty good understanding of the psychopharmacology of nicotine and used that to design their cigarettes to make them as addictive as possible. None of that was released to the public. In terms of the public face of the industry, they funded a lot of really poor quality work, generally at universities or think tanks, designed to contest the linkages between smoking and the disease, the fact that nicotine is addictive, to obscure the way they marketed to kids, to obscure the economic damage that tobacco was doing. And all of this was designed to create doubt about the emerging case that smoking was dangerous, and to provide political cover for the politicians they were making campaign contributions to in order to protect the industry politically.
Well, I know we're going to, in just a couple minutes, get into some really fascinating research that you have sponsored and led the food industry and sugar industry. But let me ask you, it seems as if one had to say what the tools that you've used, research tools, to perhaps expose and counter a multi-billion-dollar industry. How would you describe that, and what are the things you're most proud of?
Well, we now have that initial box of documents that I got has now grown to almost 90 million pages of internal industry correspondence, which is available here at the University of California, San Francisco Library online, and freely available to anyone who wants to look. And the documents, I think, have really transformed the discussion about tobacco, or in fact, not just tobacco, but, for example, the whole global warming debate, because many of the same scientists and public relations firms that worked for Big Tobacco as part of their denialism about smoking and secondhand smoke then went on to work for the big oil and coal companies to try to contest the evidence that global warming was man-made and occurring. And I think by getting behind the veil of these big industries, you can really understand how they're trying to manipulate the public discourse. And in doing that, try to discredit those efforts and drive policymaking and personal decision-making toward making decisions based on the truth rather than the propaganda campaigns of these companies.
It sure is shocking to think about the kind of denial that must be going on in these individuals' minds and how it's twisted to justify doing your work or dedicating so much attention to misrepresenting the truth. You've been very involved in some disturbing news about the history of the sugar industry's role in cardiovascular research. Give us a taste of what you found, no pun intended, with the sugar there.
Yeah, well, one thing I've learned in looking at the tobacco industry and the tobacco documents is the tremendous level of sophistication that the tobacco companies and their lawyers have had in understanding how science works and then manipulating the whole scientific discussion to steer the issues away from information that was damaging to the tobacco companies and generate a bunch of research to kind of distract people from the central questions. And what we found was that the sugar companies were doing the same thing. You know, I thought for the longest time that Big Tobacco was almost unique in pioneering the science denialism and the creation of confusion and doubt about the science, and then other industries had kind of followed them to do the same thing, the way the petrochemical industries have with global warming, for example. But it turns out the sugar industry was just as clever and just as on top of the emerging science as the cigarette companies were. And what happened was back in the 1960s, there was getting to be an understanding that diet was an important determinant of heart disease risk. And there were two bodies of evidence developing kind of in parallel. One was evidence linking fats to heart disease and a high-fat diet increasing your risk of heart disease. And the other was a high-sugar diet, because sugar would increase triglycerides, and those triglycerides were then leading to increases in heart disease. The sugar industry was very concerned about this, because if people started linking increased sugar consumption to heart disease, it might make people want to eat less sugar, which is indeed now in 2016 what's starting to happen. But back then, they saw this as both a threat and an opportunity. It was a threat because if people started to link sugar with heart disease, they would eat less sugar. But it was an opportunity because if they could shift the entire blame onto fat, then that would increase the sugar market, because food companies would be taking fats out of foods and putting sugar in their place.
We need to take a short break, but when we return, we're actually going to continue this great conversation with Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and director of the UCSF Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education, about industry support of research, Tales of Deception. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor at the University of California, San Francisco, about industry support of research, Tales of Deception. And Dr. Glantz, you had really just started to weave this really pretty remarkable tale, undermining some basic tenets, perhaps, of research by changing the narrative. And there are connections between the tobacco industry and the food industry, I've heard and know a little bit about. Tell us about that and perhaps how the role of money seems to connect those two.
Well, the tobacco companies figured out very early on how science works and how they could intervene with funding to find sympathetic investigators and try to move the discussion away from things that were damaging to tobacco and toward things that were kind of irrelevant. And the sugar industry, working through its lobbying group, the Sugar Association, figured the same thing out about the same time. And indeed, one of the people who worked for the tobacco industry actually came over from the sugar industry. And what happened in the 60s was an opportunity, if the sugar industry could shift all the blame onto fat, and then people would start putting more sugar in foods to compensate for removing the fat. And that's what actually happened. And one of the things the sugar industry did to shift the focus off of sugar onto fat was they gave money to three very well-known nutrition scientists at Harvard to write a review paper, a summary of the scientific evidence that they got published in a very prestigious place, the New England Journal of Medicine, which systematically pumped up the evidence that fat was bad for heart disease and systematically dismissed the evidence that sugar was dangerous. Now, we now know that both high fats and high sugars are bad for you. But by shifting the focus away from sugar and onto fat, the sugar industry delayed public appreciation for the role of sugar in heart disease for decades, which allowed them to make a lot of money selling more sugar than they might have sold had people recognized that high sugar is causing heart disease.
Now, help us understand the story. I mean, you told us about receiving a box in your tobacco center at UCSF years and years ago related to the tobacco industry's deception. How did you start pursuing this inquiry related to sugar, and how did you uncover all of this?
Well, the person who uncovered it was a woman who's currently a postdoctoral fellow with me named Kristen Kearns, who's a dentist. And Kristen was a practicing dentist in Denver and went to a continuing education lecture on diabetes and gum disease and asked the speaker, well, what about sugar and diabetes? And got kind of the runaround. And being an inquisitive person, she went to the public library and digging into, you know, to do some research. And it turns out the largest sugar beet processor in the country at the time had been located in Denver. And when it went out of business, it put its corporate papers in the archive in the Denver Public Library. And in there, she found communications between the Sugar Association, the sugar industry's lobbying group, and efforts to undermine a wide variety of scientific activities. that led her to contact me and come here as a postdoctoral fellow to study the sugar industry. And then she's gone to other archives and found other documents, for example, in the Harvard archives, where she found much of the material that we've been talking about. And it turns out there's thousands and thousands of pages of sugar industry documents out there that are just like the tobacco industry documents. And in fact, what we're hoping to do now, and frankly, we need to find the money to do this, is to create an online archive of sugar documents paralleling the tobacco documents, so that not only we, but people all over the world can come to understand how the sugar industry has been using its economic clout to both manipulate science and also influence policy making.
So let me ask you a question, Dr. Glantz. This tale of deception industry from tobacco to sugar, some might say, well, is this any different than the Pharmaceutical Association's roles in supporting research and a bias that comes in, that everyone has a bias? How do you answer that? Is it partly true, partly false? What?
Well, I think there's an inherent problem in all corporate funding of research, and that is a corporation's objectives are not to get to the science or to advance truth and public understanding the way, say, the National Institutes of Health or the American Heart Association or the American Cancer Society are. All corporations' goals are to make as much money as possible. And so I think all corporate funding of research is potentially problematic, because the fundamental goals of the sponsoring organization are often at odds with the goal of the scientific and academic community, which is to find and disseminate the truth to the public. Now, there are times when industrial funding of research, I think, is okay to do in an academic environment, and that's when the actual objective goals of the funding agency and the scientific enterprise are reasonably congruent. And so, for example, I think a lot of pharmaceutical companies do have a fundamental interest in getting the science right, because in order to have a product which is going to succeed in the long run, it has to work. And that means it has to be built on accurate science. So I think with regard to pharma, if you have in place very strong conflict of interest rules and disclosure rules and things that prohibit the companies from, say, editing or controlling the outcomes of the research, that's probably okay. I think the conflicts there could be managed. And I actually sit on the Conflict of Interest Committee for the University of California, San Francisco, and have to deal with these every month. And I have to say, there are places where faculty get out of line on this matter. I think the situation is different when you're talking about things like the tobacco companies, or now we're learning the sugar-sweetened beverage companies and other sugar companies, because their fundamental interest is actually to inhibit the development of science and the dissemination of science, because the better the scientific understanding of the dangers of smoking or secondhand smoke or e-cigarettes or sugar-sweetened beverages are, it's just fundamentally antithetical to the business interests of these sponsors. And so they're going to use the sponsorship of research in order to inhibit the development of the science and to inhibit the development of public understanding of these risks. And I think when that's the case, that universities should be taking their money.
Agreed.
Because it's antithetical to the whole mission of the university.
Now, Dr. Glantz, I would imagine you're talking about taking on tobacco industry, talking about oil companies. Now you're talking about all these, you know, Coca-Cola and all these different large industries that have been involved in this. And I would imagine there's some personal cost to you for shedding light to a lot of these dangers, the inhibition of science and funding of untruths. How have you had to face that?
Well, I haven't yet felt the full wrath of the sugar industry.
But you know it's coming.
The kind of funny thing is that when they have complained about our research, our response has been, I don't see what they're complaining about. We've shown what a great job they did of distorting the whole process and protecting their profits. So from their point of view, they've done a good job, and they all deserve to be promoted. But the tobacco companies have sued the University of California twice trying to stop our work. They've tried to put riders on both state and federal legislation to shut our work down. They forced, through their allies in Congress, an investigator general investigation of the National Cancer Institute a couple of years ago for supporting our work. They regularly put in Freedom of Information Act requests to scrutinize every little thing that we're doing. But, you know, it's just what they do. You have to, if you're going to be doing work in areas that are economically threatening to these powerful industry interests, you just have to be ready to deal with it.
Well, it takes a strong character.
Fortunately, the University of California and the National Institutes of Health, which is the major funding source for our work, have remained, you know, very supportive of this work. They've recognized the importance of it, and they've defended it. And, you know, both of them have taken a certain amount of heat from these business interests and their political allies, but they've said our mission is getting to the truth.
Well, and that
and
support
good science
surely highlights their integrity and also
yes.
yours in being able to be strong as you've been uncovering important things for our nation's health and for our listeners' health.
Well, Dr. Glantz, we're going to need to put a pause in the conversation, but I think we want to thank you on behalf of public health and the mission of the public to have views that help them really understand better where perhaps science can really make inroads honestly and with ethical integrity. And we want to thank you for being a champion of that over many decades.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, about tales of deception, industry support of research. We're going to take a short break, and coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to talk a few minutes about your health questions and your concerns.
And Christy, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about someone who's pregnant and has an elevated blood pressure.
I'm pregnant with my first child, and my doctor recently diagnosed me with mild preeclampsia. This development has me pretty anxious. Any advice?
Well, thank you for sharing this with us and for reaching out for advice. This can be scary. I can share personally that I had preeclampsia with both of my children. And even though I know enough as being a family physician who delivers babies and takes care of people with preeclampsia every day, it is still, it's very different when it's your own body. And it's also confusing because preeclampsia, in terms of its causes, are not as well understood as many other things in medicine. And so what we do know for this is that the treatment, if you're at term, is to deliver the baby. So we often will induce a patient to go ahead and deliver, and that is the cure. Depending on how severe it is, you may need medications like magnesium or other things to help reduce the risk of seizures, which is the real concern with preeclampsia. For the older people listening, this was the thing that we used to call toxemia of pregnancy.
And it's very scary, and it can be scary, but with good care today, we should be able to prevent and preserve maternal health and child health in almost all circumstances. I will say that sometimes we hear questions when women come in for care about, is there anything they can do to prevent preeclampsia? And if you're at low risk for developing preeclampsia, you've no family history, you've never really had, your blood pressure has been low, really we wouldn't recommend much other than perhaps optimal weight and obviously good care. But if you were at higher risk, that may be a case that your doctor may actually consider giving you low-dose aspirin. So you certainly could talk with your doctor and see if you have any risk factors.
And for you, it sounds like depending on how the gestational age of your baby will determine the recommendations that are made, but certainly very close follow-up with your doctor is important. Following those recommendations, delivering at the time that you guys decide is important, and then following up afterwards to make sure your blood pressure comes back down to normal, which it almost always does, and also that you have close follow-up because you will be at higher risk for your next pregnancy. So you may want to talk to your doctor about taking an aspirin.
Next question.
Our 3-year-old is an incredibly picky eater. Do you have any suggestions for approaching the daily battle over food and making sure my son gets the nutrients he needs?
Well, I think you have to be creative. I think you have to be willing to figure out and work with the child. So it may be the cereal that they're eating, you might be able to put some fruit with the cereal to get them to eat fruit if they're not eating fruit regularly.
Well, I'll tell you, with my first baby, everyone was getting all into pureeing vegetables and slipping them into the cookies and doing all these very time-intensive things. And I thought, what? Just tell her to open her mouth and eat it, because I had a very obedient first child. And then the next one came along and definitely humbled me and my husband as parents and challenged us. And there was a year there where all he would eat were moon nuts, cashews, and blueberries, which, you know, is funny to us now. That wouldn't it be great if he went back to that diet? But, yeah, we just had to work with what we had. And you have some few lists, and we can put it on our website, of some recommendations, Adam.
Well, I have one thing I would recommend you not do, which is don't give desserts as a reward for trying a new food. You can try new foods and always have them around and model good behavior. But we'll put a few tips up there from our health sciences librarians. Laura, what's our very next house call?
As the weather has gotten colder, I find that I'm having increased nosebleeds. Is this anything to be concerned about?
Well, I think it is concerning if your nose is bleeding, and that's never something that you want to have happen. Whether it's concerned about like coming to your doctor versus trying some simple things like maybe putting some Vaseline to increase moisture in your nose, well, that's a different question.
Yep. So, I mean, if you're having them repeatedly and they're really hard to control and you'd like to pursue someone maybe cauterizing the blood vessel to, if there's a particular place that, I mean, if it's really extreme, well, then, yeah, you should go get that checked out. And maybe there are interventions. There are these simple things like putting a little bit of Vaseline inside your nose in the place where it's bleeding or where it sometimes bleeds, using a humidifier to keep the air moist. Avoid picking your nose, which sounds obvious, but the most common cause for nosebleeds is digital trauma.
If you use the Q-tip with a little Vaseline, it's a good tip.
Oh, hey.
Oh, okay.
Nicely
done.
On
that note, Laura, what's your very last house call?
I've had a persistent but mild cough for several weeks now. It's not problematic for me, but it is getting annoying. What could be causing this?
Lots of things. Okay, we'll go back and forth. You could have seasonal allergies causing postnasal drip.
You might have a little bit of reflux of acid, and it's irritating your esophagus.
You could have a cold or a virus that's hanging on for a while.
Your doctor may have given you a medication, and I told you, it causes cough.
There could be other environmental triggers that are making you cough.
It may just be a virus or idiopathic.
Got you.
We
went back.
Don't know.
Got you. Okay. Well,
did you already say that once?
I did.
Oh, it could be a different virus.
That's right. Good point. All right. So hopefully those are just a few things that could do it. You know, it sounds like it's not bothering you that much, but if it becomes more persistent, then do go check it out with your doctor, because it could be something like a medication change that could make it better. Thank you for your house calls and your questions today. We've had some good ones today, and we thank you for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or get our health app on iTunes.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Stanton Glantz. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carrboro's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.